Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Rule Brewster, the founder and chair of the Pacific Islands Heritage Foundation, with a mission to preserve the cultural and natural landscapes of Micronesia, Melanesia, and Polynesia. Rule leads PIHF in promoting education, health, and sustainable development. His extensive experience in project development and leadership has equipped him to spearhead impactful initiatives that both benefit local communities and the environment. I've asked him to join us here today to share his story and about doing business across Asia. So, Rule, thank you so much for joining us, my friend. How are you?
Oh, it's good to see you. It's good to see you. We're like 20 minutes away from each other, I heard.
That's right. Yes, we are. We're both having heavy rains right now, and it's good.
Oh, things from the beautiful city of Manila.
So,
oh, gosh.
Before we get into what you're currently working on, can you walk me through, because I know you're a very well-connected individual. You spent, I think you said, over 22 years, 25 years in China, doing business in and around China. You could bring a wealth of experience. How did you even, what was your first step into the business world?
It's a good one, Daryl. I was a youngster. It's a bit of a unique background. I was 18 years old in Holland, where I'm originally from. And I hopped on a plane and ended up in Taiwan at the university. I had a passion for languages, and I decided to choose Mandarin Chinese, 1985. Wow. Ended up graduating there, one of the first Westerners in Taiwan. Wow. And from there on, I ended up in what at that time was really third world China, 1989, 1990. I was there during the Tiananmen Square situation. So I have lived and worked in China in the very early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, for a very brief period of time. Ended up not really liking it. I was a youngster, my early 20s at that time. I didn't like China at all. It was very hard to live there as a foreigner. A lot of restrictions on our life, and it is not comparable to the China that we see now. So I left for about, I'd say about 9 or 10 years. Ended up in Malaysia for that period. And I got called back in 2001 by a Chinese property investor. And he hired me, and I spearheaded his luxury property development and hotel divisions in South China, in Guangzhou, a city previously called Canton, not too far from Hong Kong. So that's where it all started. I arrived in Feb 2001 on a four-year agreement, a four-year contract, and ended up living in that same city for 20 years.
Wow. So yeah. You say it wasn't comparable to China now. What do you mean?
No, totally different. Totally different. I have seen things in 1989 that there's no words to describe that. China, I was actually living in the city of Xi'an, X-I-A-N, which is where the terracotta soldiers were discovered in the early days. That's like central North China. And 1989 was tough. I worked for the Hyatt Hotels. We were building the first international property in that city. And I was responsible for human resources and training and development. And we had to recruit over 1,000 staff. And we quickly found out that they had no, with no disrespect intended, no common sense as far as service standards, hotel requirements, interaction with international clientele is concerned. They had never seen Westerners. We'd walk on the streets and we would have a local Chinese deputy trailing us wherever we went. I used to go for my morning runs and a deputy would be assigned to me for my safety, they said. But frankly speaking, they just wanted to know where I was running to.
Yeah, that's like Vietnam, when I was in Vietnam.
I was a youngster, I mean, in my early 20s, so it really didn't matter. But my first impressions of China were absolutely not good, 1989, 1990, that's for sure. But of course, that changed. Huh? And once I got back, I've been party to the amazing development of what China has become. I've seen it firsthand. I have many stories to tell you, but I think my main takeaway is I've immersed myself in China. My entire fledgling career has taken place in China. I have worked with Chinese bosses, Chinese management companies, Chinese boards of directors. I have primarily worked in local organizations, very often being the only Westerner sitting on the board or sitting in the management team. So I've delved very deep into their modus operandi, their local way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And that has opened a lot of doors for me because I do, you may know, but I do speak the language. I'm fairly fluent in Chinese.
Right, yeah. Which is a huge...
I read and write, yeah. So that makes a great deal of difference, obviously. Right. And having worked with and been engaged in the local community with local companies and organizations, that kind of gives you a head start, I would say. I was never expatriated like many others. I never worked for an international bank or an international airline. I ended up working for local successful entrepreneurs who made it. And I was very frequently sitting as the right-hand person in the boardrooms. So absolutely very interesting. Yes, for sure.
Yeah, and what would you share? Because obviously it's a huge economy, huge market. There's a lot of people that wish they could understand how to do business with and engage in China. What would you recommend to someone either struggling or starting out with trying to connect with China, if only just to diversify their customer base?
The Chinese, I admire the fortitude of the Chinese. They are able to make the most of all situations. They are able to make you feel very welcome as a Westerner. They will welcome your business interests as a Westerner, and they will open any doors for you, give you the red carpet, and make you very comfortable. So an entry into China as a fledgling entrepreneur from a Western country, I find that to be increasingly easy. Contrary to what you may read in mass media, I find it very easy. China is extremely efficient. The entry requirements to open a company, to open bank accounts, these are all being facilitated. These are all simplified as compared to 10, 15, 20 years ago. There are no real hindrances for Westerners to be successful in China at the micro and mid-level. I'm not talking about stock market listed companies and intergovernmental issues, but as an entrepreneur, like how I came to that country, I think it is, I don't see any obstacles. But of course, you need to be respectful. You need to understand what makes the Chinese tick. And being able to communicate in their own language, even if it's a few words, will be much appreciated. So I have a lot of confidence in doing business with China. I have a very positive outlook on the mindset of the people. I read the Western newspapers, I read the Chinese newspapers, and maybe my opinion may seem to be a little bit biased because I've lived there for so long, but I would disagree with that. I've actually lived there and felt it and sensed it and experienced it. And I think people all around the world are very similar. They're all interested in safety, security, and economic progress. So they're not any different. They just, they may speak a different language, they may have a different value system, but for me personally, I fit in quite easily there.
Are there any cultural norms one should be aware of when doing business there that you can think of? It's a broad question, but...
What can I say? Many years ago, I was the founding chairman of the European Union Chamber of Commerce's Southern China District. And I managed a team of specialists that facilitated the entry of European companies into China and represented the interests of European companies already in China. So fairly large responsibility. I remember one time I spoke to a group of European investors that came on a recce visit. They were told back in Europe that when they come to China, they have to bow to people, they have to be respectful, they have to give their name cards to them with two hands.
That's Japan. You
know, that's Japan. That's exactly. But I'm trying to answer your question. The Chinese of 2024 in the business field are as educated and as experienced as you and I. They have traveled the world. Their English ability is amazing. Even though they may not let you know, they understand everything you're saying. Many of them have traveled over. But they are not to be, I would say, to be very deferential to. They should just be treated equally. Just blunt, straightforward, no nonsense. I get a little tired of seeing Westerners going to China and acting overly cautious because they're meeting with people from a different part of the world. Overly cautious. I think that's the right way to say it. There's no need for that. You just talk to them as you and I speak.
Right.
There's no difference. Not at all.
Yeah, okay. Good. Fair enough. Fair enough answer. Fair enough answer. Yeah, you never know. There's always customs in different places. I have a friend, our daughters go to the same private school here, and he does a lot of business in Singapore. And he was talking about in meetings, dress code is actually, he said, dress code's important. You don't dress up too much. khakis and a collared shirt's fine, but it's got to be a name brand collared shirt. Otherwise, no one will do business with you. And I thought that was interesting. And I lived in Japan for 3 years, and I feel like it took me a year and a half to live there until I realized how rude I was being to people just by day-to-day existence. Because while we typically have rude, casual, polite, vernacular ways of speaking, in Japan, they have 5 levels of etiquette. I had a friend, he was there for 16 years, got married. And he said on his wedding day, it was like a scene out of a movie, because he went to bed the night before talking to everybody, speaking fluently in Japanese. And he woke up the next day and he couldn't understand what anybody was saying to him. And it was because they were all talking to him in the highest level of etiquette. So it was like, he was like, I was ushered through my day and people were saying things and I wasn't getting. And the day before I had understood whatever these people said. And it's because he'd never heard that tier of etiquette. You just never know. You just never know. But I've only been through Hong Kong airport a dozen times.
So I think what I like in particular, in terms of doing business in and with and working in and with China, I like the fact that Chinese listen very well. They don't say much. They listen, they absorb. So Chinese are not generally known for their small talk. They're not very, they don't come across as very bubbly. Chinese will just sit quietly in the corner. And that's nothing to do with being shy or being uncomfortable or nervous. It is really, their nature is to speak only when they deem it essential. They absorb what's going on in meetings more than you would ever know, and the end result will impress you. Just a case in point, I worked for many years in Guangzhou for a Chinese property developer. And this property developer is one of the, I'd say, one of the top five in China. I was the vice president for one of their divisions. I had a staff of in excess of 1,000. And I sat in the board, and there's about 12 directors, vice presidents, all very formal meetings every 2 weeks or so. And I'd sit there. I'm the only Westerner. And I looked at how the chairman organized this meeting. So he would walk in, he wouldn't say a single word. And every one of these 12 directors or vice presidents or presidents, they would have a pre-prepared statement, and they would be reading it out. What have they been doing over the last 2 weeks? What are their concerns? What are their issues that they need to debate? What do they need approval for? So the chairman sits there and he's listening to literally to 11 opinions without saying a single word. It's just all 11 monologues. He's absorbing all of this. He asks a few questions and he gets 11 opinions. And until that moment, he's been nearly silent. And then at the very end, he is a decision maker. He doesn't debate, he doesn't critique, he doesn't engage in discussions. He's formed his opinion while listening to 11 senior executives. You follow what I'm trying to say? Meetings are, you need to imagine you're sitting in a room and you have 11 monologues. I'm repeating myself, 11 monologues with one person listening.
Yep.
And he decides, yes, no, this is the budget, I approve, I disapprove, done.
Yep.
Meetings last for 20 minutes, half an hour, done. That's the board meeting. There's no debates, no internal discussions, no arguments, no raising voices, no pointing fingers. Very peaceful, very organized, very structured, super effective. And I like that. I like that. I think
very paternal. Quite
something to be said for that.
It's very paternal.
Very efficient.
Yeah.
Correct. Correct.
When you're talking that, it made me sound like a big family at a dinner table type thing, almost, to a certain extent, where they might talk amongst each other.
Patriarchal. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
They say paternal. I say, yeah, it's patriarchal. But
not patriarchal. You know,
at the end of the day, someone's got to make the decisions to get things done.
Yeah.
So now you're not in China anymore. So why did you leave the country and how did you end up here?
I would say about 5-6 years ago, I started spreading my wings a little bit. My children, I have 3 kids, and they all grew up in China. They're not Chinese. My kids are of mixed parentage. They are Malaysian, Dutch, but they are really raised in China. My youngest one was a few months old when we got to China. So they know nothing but China. So once they graduated from their respective high schools, they all flew the coop and went to university in Australia. So there was no real purpose for me to be in China permanently because I wanted to stay there until the kids would leave high school. As I said, I don't want to be expatriated. I don't want my kids to be uprooted every 3 or 4 years. I deliberately decided to stay in Guangzhou until they all graduate from high school. So they have a bit of a sense of having roots in one location. So once they left for Australia, where they still live, I decided to diversify a little bit. I've been involved in all these large Chinese organizations, so I have a fairly decent network. And I started recommending the Chinese to look outward in terms of their investment. Outward, not necessarily to Western countries, but to the Pacific. I've always been very passionate about the Pacific for personal reasons, but I decided to introduce opportunities to Chinese in the Pacific Islands, initially in Micronesia, which is the area near Guam, Saipan, Palau, Federated States of Micronesia, that I would say northern Pacific region, or the islands just north of the equator, at least. So long story short, I brought a few investors from Hong Kong and from Macau to the island of Saipan. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Saipan, but yep. Saipan is U.S. territory, just about an hour north of Guam.
Right.
Through some lobbying and 2 years of blood, sweat, and tears, I would say, we managed to secure an exclusive gaming license for this developer, and he committed to a 2,000-room luxury hotel. It's a massive project. It was slated for $7.1 billion for a very small island. So it quickly became untenable, I would say, because my role was to secure the permits and to engage with the local authorities so that my investor would be welcome. Very quickly, I noticed that his vision had become an untenable vision, an unrealistic vision. His hotel from 2,000 rooms became 3,000 rooms. His investment from 600 million became 7.1 billion. A lot of nonsense, huh? So to cut the long story short, and you can Google this, there's a lot of information online on this. The entire project pancaked. He hit the wall running. He invested heavily in the island, but due to his ignorance and perhaps his personal pride, he failed. He engaged illegal workers from China to build the project. Despite our very obvious warnings, there were a lot of issues in terms of operational safety and hazard during the construction. So at the end of the day, the government shut the entire project down completely and is now, years later, in the process of revoking the exclusive gaming license. And it's quite a disaster. So my role in this was during the initial stages, pre-construction. Okay, so I can wash my hands in innocence a little bit, but I have been party to this. And that's just one example. It's a typical example of a Chinese investor going to a very small island, wanting to do something beautiful and commercially viable, but forgetting the needs of the local community and the limitations that developing on very small island nations in the Pacific offer. You understand where I'm getting at?
Yeah, so, in terms of labor and resources and material.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Even capacity.
In a nutshell, and I've been involved in several of such projects in the Pacific, I have noted that the Chinese would come in with lots of energy and passion and love, but they would their dream would outgrow reality. It would be more about what they want, what they expect, and they would not keep in mind what the local community would be comfortable with. What is it that these islands can accept? What is it that the infrastructure can handle? Having said that, I thought I need to reverse my direction. I don't need to push investors to the small, fragile islands of the Pacific just like this. I need to work in a reverse order. I need to speak with the communities in the Pacific Islands before I marry an investor to them, rather than the opposite, the Chinese coming to the Pacific and overwhelming the local communities and putting undue pressure on the environment, on the local infrastructure, as I said earlier. So I said to myself, reverse course, go different. So what I then did is I thought the best way to concrete investment that with a long life and viable profitability attached to it is to mindset of the islanders define what it is that they are comfortable with and describe that very clearly in a white paper document and present that to potential investors. So you know what I'm trying to say. I call it my wish list. So I speak with, there are 19 countries in the Pacific. I communicate with 19 agencies in these individual countries and try to communicate with them to provide me details of what it is that these islands would be happy to approve in terms of project development from an international investor. So that makes a lot of sense to me. And I get a lot of positive feedback from the island communities and from the local authorities on this island. So I thought I need a vehicle, a non-commercial vehicle, to make this all very palatable. So I came up with the idea, with not myself, but a team of us, came up with the idea to register a nonprofit foundation, a properly incorporated, chartered, legit nonprofit foundation, to be the vehicle through which we carry such investment wish lists.
Right.
In a nutshell, an island nation like the Federated States of Micronesia, they speak with me, they say, hey, we are looking to upgrade our container port, our very small container port. We're looking for an investor. We're willing to relinquish X percentage of the project to the foreign investor. We're looking to build a 100-room hotel. We're looking to build an extension to our hospital. We need, what can you do? So I will travel to China and I will try and find the right investor who is able and willing to not only step in and execute the project, but also come in with a basket of goodwill. I like the idea of being partially commercial and partially developmental oriented.
Corporate social responsibility.
You're something along those lines.
It sounds like you're trying to offer a way for Chinese investors to have corporate social responsibility first relationship with these island nations.
Correct.
So they can come in.
For one case in point, for example, there's a particular project in one of the islands. I'm not at liberty to tell you which island I will let you know once I sign the agreement. But this particular island is willing to work with an investor that I've brought to the table. And we're looking at a 200-room luxury hotel and some private homes and a vocational college. And one of the benefits that the country has asked for, they call it the community chest, is an X-ray machine for their very, very impoverished hospital. They have no X-ray machine. So I went to China and I said, look, this is the location. This is the size of the land. This is pre-approved, or at least it's green channeled.
Right.
My suggestion is that you donate that X-ray machine first.
Yeah.
Donate it. And don't have too many expectations. Just go with me to the island, donate it officially, put your name on it, call it the Mr. Lee X-ray donation. And or Mr. whatever it is, MRI or X-ray machine, in this case it's an X-ray machine, donated. You will create immediate, instantaneous goodwill with the local community.
Yep.
Once. It will cost you a pittance. You are seen to be doing good. And then once you have, this is not a bribe. This is an official public donation. Once you have established yourself as an investor with good intentions, we are able to green light your project fairly smoothly. There will be hardly any objections. You are appreciated as an investor. They already know you. They love you. They like you. And they know that you have a deep understanding of what the limitations and the expectations on these small island nations are.
Right.
So these investors are welcomed with open arms. They may not come in with thousands and thousands of hotel rooms because that doesn't make any sense in these island nations.
Right.
Here we're looking at very much micro investment, talking about very small projects, 50, 100, 200 rooms, hotels, for example. Many of the things we try to do are in the tourism industry, obviously. That's the angle.
Yeah, I respect that a lot. So I mentioned, I think, before that in 2020, when everyone was arguing about the science, because the man who raised me worked in applied physics and geology, it made me ask, what does the science have to say about business success? So I hired 10 assistants, spent about 50 grand to go through all the academic literature on business success to figure out what are the common denominators. And we identified 8 critical success factors. And those were self-efficacy, market intelligence, strategic planning, marketing strategy, sales strategy and skills, money management, business operations, and business intelligence. And when we drilled into each of those, now we have the big umbrellas. Let's drill into each. When we drilled into each of those, marketing strategy, one of the most successful pillars of its corporate social responsibility. Marketing strategy is based off of market intelligence, the quality and fit, the characteristics of the product, an intense amount of advertising and networking. Like, people don't understand, intense advertising and networking, brand integrity and trustworthiness, corporate social responsibility, and of course, scientific type testing. And the corporate social responsibility has always been correlated to a positive ROI, as long as it's carried out in terms of community development, ethical values, and conforming to legal processes, right?
You summed it up very brilliantly. It is, to me, it's all summed up by saying you have to have local knowledge and respect for the local community. That's key. When you have cross-border investment in very needy communities like in the Pacific Basin. So a very thorough local understanding and respect for the way of how things are being done on the islands will go a very long way.
Right. We made a joke before about neighbors before we hit record on the call. And I think it's easy to demonstrate if you live in a subdivision and there's a lot beside you, and maybe you don't own it, but there's an empty lot there and someone's going to build a house. And you're going to have construction for a year or whatever while they build that house. And then you're going to have a neighbor that you don't know if you're going to like them or not. But before any of that happens, this person comes in and either donates or fixes up the kids' playground and puts in a community garden in the space. And it's like, you've got this little park for all the kids. And before they move in, they go and they fix all that. Hey, who did that? And someone, oh, he did that. Hey, he's going to be my neighbor. And all of a sudden, the whole thing is framed differently. And so maybe you would build the house anyways, but now instead of showing up with the nuisance and the friction and the contractors and all that first, you just come in and you're like, hey, I'm here to add value to this community first. Do you mind if I go take this lot over here and do something with it because it's for sale or whatever?
Yeah. I like that. I've always been in high strung jobs in China. Having switched my focus to the Pacific has been very good for me personally as well. I ended up on the island of Palau, the Republic of Palau. I had a meeting with the former president of the country, who is a partner of mine in the foundation. And as I landed on the island, 2 days later, COVID-19 closed the world down, and there were no boats and no planes. And I got stuck on this rock for 2 years and 4 months with a backpack. And that was an eye-opener for me. It actually made me realize what's important in life. This sounds all soft and emotional. That's not the intention.
It's real.
It did. I pressed the reset button and I said to myself, this is something I need to do. I'm not a charitable organization. Whatever it is that we do, we are fully self-financing all our own activities. So we're not just spreading the cash around or anything of that nature. I like the idea of doing good and creating projects that have a long life and benefit the communities of these islands. I like it. Yeah. It makes me feel good. I feel better about myself. There are a lot of obstacles. We are a fledgling organization. We're not comparable to the big players in the market, but I think we're one of the very few private organizations that are trying to make a difference in the Pacific. There are governmental associations, so intergovernmental associations. There are global organizations like ADB Bank, based in Manila, Asian Development Bank. You have USAID, you have Japan Aid, you have Australia Aid. You have the Pacific Island Forum, which is a congregation of the leaders of the 19 Pacific nations. These are major regional and global organizations. UNDP, United Nations Development Program, is very big in the Pacific. We can't compare with that. We are a private initiative, and we try to make a difference one step at a time, one island at a time. It is an uphill battle for us, to be very honest, but I'm very passionate about what we're trying to do. And we have high hopes. We're surrounded by very capable people on all of the 19 countries that I made reference to earlier. We have identified, I call it the honorary chairperson. If you go to my website, you'll see there's an honorary chairperson in the island of Tonga and in the Solomon Islands in Papua New Guinea. These are very impactful people. That kind of think like my partners and myself. Not only focus on me, myself, and I, and not only with a commercial mind, but a bit of both. A bit of goodwill thrown in, I would say. So we work with 19 like-minded individuals. If I have questions about opportunities or issues in one of the nations, I can speak with our honorary chair. And these people may be retired officials. They may be, in the case of Tonga, related to the royal family of the islands, former executives in the Chamber of Commerce, people that work with the civic society organizations. So it's a nice basket of different people, but all with a similar mindset. And all of them are doing this pro bono. We're not paying anybody. We have got great people that are donating their time and their efforts into creating this vision. But this is, again, this is not easy to talk about it, but to put it into effect is a whole different ballgame.
If people wanted to get in touch, if they wanted to connect, what are some of the best ways for them to reach out?
Let me perhaps say what I am particularly looking for. I am interested in looking for, I need people to help strategically think with us. I am looking for partners. I'm not saying financial investors. That's not the reason why I'm on this program at all. Don't get me wrong. I'm looking for, I like to create some sort of a think tank or a task force where I can get some fresh perspectives, some fresh ideas, and have a group of like-minded people that can sit around the table with me and some of our key people to hash out ideas and to identify the ways forward and identify funding models. Obviously, funding is important, but it would be good to have people engage with me a little bit. I'm looking for some assistance in social media. We have our LinkedIn profile, our Facebook profile, our Instagram profile, but we don't have the specialists to create the daily content. So in that regard, we're still very meager. We don't have much of an online presence. We have the frameworks in place. We have the accounts in place, but we don't have the creative people that are willing to work with us and get our message across and create online content to profile and promote the activities that we try to engage with. So that is a little bit hard for us at the moment. How to connect with us? The easiest way would be email, to be very frank. That's the we're everywhere. You can find us online. The website is pih.foundation, pih.foundation. And you could get me at info@pih.foundation very easily. That would probably be the best.
Perfect. Yeah. So send an email, info@P as in Paul, I as in information, H as in happy, .foundation.
Or that's
go
right.
To the website, pih.foundation.
Or that's send right. An email. That's right.
And send a message. Thank you so much, Rule. Thank you for your time. Thank you for sharing your stories with us. It has been an honor and a pleasure.
Look forward to meeting you in the flesh one of these days. That would be nice.
Yeah, we'll make it happen. Thank you so much.
I like what you stand for, and I appreciate that you gave me this platform. Very nice of you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you. Thank you.